So, I'm sure you know that there's weather on planet Earth because you experience it every day. But did you know that there's also weather in space? Yeah, this podcast is going to talk all about that, and you're going to learn about things like geomagnetic storms and meteor showers and all kinds of things that happen in space. All right, we're going to start off today's podcast with a significant historical event when it comes to space weather, but first, a definition. First definition, Earth's magnetosphere. So around our planet, we have two poles, the North Pole and the South Pole. The reason they're called this is because we basically have a giant bubble of magnetic field kind of surrounding the planet, and it protects us from space stuff, which we're about to talk about. So Earth's magnetosphere is just that bubble that I'm talking about. Second definition, solar wind. So solar wind is created by the outward expansion of plasma, also known as charged particles, from the sun's corona. That's the outermost layer of the sun's atmosphere. And the plasma is blasted towards us through space. And as it then interacts with the magnetosphere, then we have something that are called geomagnetic storms. So we normally have interactions between solar wind and the Earth's magnetosphere, but sometimes there are periods of very high-speed solar wind, or maybe for a long period of time, like several hours or maybe a couple of days. That is when we classify it as a geomagnetic storm. Now, there are classifications. There's a scale for geomagnetic storms, so that can be anywhere from a G1 to a G5 on the scale of geomagnetic storms, a G1 being a minor storm, a G5 being an extreme storm. And minor storms can cause weak power fluctuations in our power grids. It can impact our satellite operations, so you might have those when there's like your GPS signal is kind of fading in and out, that can be caused by a geomagnetic storm. And also animals can be affected by geomagnetic storms. But as we get towards the more extreme end of the scale, this can cause complete catastrophic blackouts and failure. So transformers can be completely damaged. We can have loss of connection to satellites. Radio navigation can be out for hours, and auroras can be seen as far south as possibly Florida and Texas, which is not normal. So very, very high geomagnetic storm events are going to have more significant impacts. And just a brief reminder that auroras are the bright colored lights in the sky that are the excited oxygen and nitrogen molecules being hit by the solar wind in the ionosphere, and then it kind of makes these ribbons and curtains of light, usually in northern latitudes. Okay, now we go back in time. So 99 years ago, in the month of May, this is May 1921, there was something called the Great Geomagnetic Storm of May 1921. Just being dramatic, but seriously, there was a very significant geomagnetic storm in May 1921, and it caused a lot of disruptions in the signal service, which is the telegraph system. I know, a little bit old school, but think of it as kind of first-rate text messaging, sort of, except through dots and dashes. And what happened is there is a major corona mass ejection, or CME, that was directed towards Earth for 3 days. The Earth's magnetic field was impacted by this corona mass ejection. And to scientists at the time, it was really kind of a surprise because they didn't really know about these type of storms yet. So we had magnometers suddenly going like off the scale. And it sort of like ripped off the piece of paper, and it's like, oh my gosh, something crazy is happening, but they didn't know what it was. But then it gets better because, and when I say better, I mean worse, because then the telegraph towers start bursting into flame. So, yeah, the telegraph exchange in Sweden, around 2 a.m. GMT time, burst into flame, and then an hour later, across the Atlantic, the same thing happened in the state of New York, and then later, a New England station also had a fire, and so we just had all these fires happening. And this is because of a surge of electrical current caused by the geomagnetic activity. It then goes through the telegraph and the telephone lines, it heats them up, so then it spontaneously combusts, which is kind of awesome, but not really at the same time. And so we have all these fires. It also disrupted the telegraph system in Australia, Brazil, Denmark, France, Japan, New Zealand, Norway, Sweden, the UK, and the US. And during the storm's peak on May 15th in 1921, there were cities like Los Angeles and Atlanta having northern lights, which is crazy. It was seen as far south as Texas, and in the Pacific Ocean, they had red auroras all the way down in Samoa and Tonga. And all of this came courtesy of one sunspot, which was named AR 1842, which caused the corona mass ejection that then caused the solar wind, which then caused all these subsequent things. So, bottom line here is there is space weather. One thing in space weather is geomagnetic storms. It can cause quite a bit of damage. And we definitely have to look out for this in the future. Such a magnitude event, if it was to happen now, would probably cause regional power outages, probably impact our satellite system. Loss of GPS, of course, and then the trickle down effect from that, which would be can we get to 911 centers and logistics, and can people communicate if there's no radio? So, all those kind of things could be impacted by that. So, we should be preparing for the next May 1921 geomagnetic storm. Next up in the space weather category, let's talk about the pink supermoon. Now, it wasn't really pink, and this was about a month and a half ago as of the printing of this podcast. And it was April 7, 2020. The pink supermoon, the biggest supermoon of 2020, is actually named for a pink wildflower called the Phlox subulatara, which blooms in eastern North America in the early springtime. So, because it coincides roughly around that time, they named it the Pink Moon. And because it is a supermoon, it was appearing to be approximately 7% bigger and significantly brighter than an average full moon in the night sky, hence the super part. So, super pink moon. If you didn't get a chance to see the pink supermoon, I highly recommend that you Google it. It was absolutely gorgeous. I was outside during that time taking pictures. Of course, I don't have official astronomy equipment, but I could definitely tell that it was brighter. I didn't see any sort of pink hue, so that's definitely the vernacular, but not actual in color. But it was brilliant to see nonetheless. So, pink supermoon. So, also in April, it is now officially 4 years until the next great American solar eclipse. That is April 8th, 2024. Now, if you missed the last one, the last American viewpoint of a solar eclipse was back in August 21st, 2017, and it became visible initially on the coast of Oregon, and then it crossed kind of down towards the southeast, across the middle of the United States, and it was total only through this very narrow 70-mile-wide corridor that went through 14 of the continuous United States. That was Oregon, Idaho, Montana, a little bit of it, Wyoming, Nebraska, Kansas, Iowa, Missouri, Illinois, Kentucky, Tennessee, Georgia, North Carolina, and South Carolina, and then it went out into the Atlantic Ocean. And this one was the first total solar eclipse visible in the United States since July 11th, 1991, which was only seen from part of Hawaii, and the first visible from the contiguous United States since 1979. So it was kind of a big deal. Now, there is a lot of controversy when it came to this eclipse because, first of all, you have to have special glasses to look at the sun, obviously. And there was a huge counterfeit eclipse glasses market, I guess, that came out. And people bought these counterfeit eclipse glasses, and then they're, susceptible to eye damage. So that was kind of a big deal. Also, there were a lot of cameras that got damaged during the eclipse because people are like taking the pictures, and it's not really used to having that much intensity of light. And the focus on these cameras. So people tried to return their cameras. Now, the professor went down to South Carolina, kind of on a spur of the moment trip, but don't ask. And I went down to South Carolina to see the eclipse. I had my official gear because I used to work at NASA, so I still have friends there, and they gave me some official eclipse glasses. So I go down. And I ended up at Sassafras Mountain, South Carolina, which is the highest point in South Carolina because I wanted to see the 365 degree sunset. And what I mean by that is once the eclipse reaches totality, then the sun is completely obscured for, I think it was about 2 minutes, like less than, it wasn't that long. But it obscures the sun completely, and what happens is it looks like there's a sunset all the way around you, which is really awesome because the only time you normally see a sunset is going to be in the west because that's where the sun is setting for us because, we're on Earth, so we have a horizon, and so it's going down in the west, and so you see, sunset in the west. But in this case, because all of the sun is obscured, it looks like there's a sunset all around you, and it was absolutely an amazing experience, and I wouldn't trade it for the world. Now, did I actually get to see the totality and the sun being covered? The answer is no, because I was in South Carolina and there was like so many clouds. Also, afterwards, this was the secondary kind of reason people didn't go see it, is like the traffic was awful. It took me 2.5 days to get back from South Carolina, and it normally takes only about 8.5 to 9 hours. And for some reason, I thought that I could make it all the way back home in one night, which is crazy. So I end up actually making two stops, and there were just time because everyone is in this little teeny stretch of 70 miles across land to see the eclipse, and it was just madness. Like, there was traffic everywhere, like places where there isn't normally traffic, there was traffic. And when I say traffic, I mean we weren't moving. Like, there was no movement whatsoever. And so I slowly, slowly, slowly crawled my way back home. And I get back 3 days later to Maryland. But again, I wouldn't trade the experience for anything in the world. I think it was amazing. Maybe there could have been more traffic regulations, but hey, it was a great experience. Everyone else, I hope, had a great experience as well. So, point being, 4 years from now, in April 2024, there will be another total eclipse of the sun that's going to go across North America. So, start planning now and get that hotel room booked and plan that trip so that you can see the next solar eclipse in North America. Now, here's kind of a positive story that comes out of this whole shutdown coronavirus thing. When it comes to viewing space and space weather and space objects, it can be kind of difficult because there's something called light pollution. And light pollution just means that there are things on the ground that are obscuring the sky, and meaning from a light source. So when we shut down, say, then we tend to have a better view. There's actually a society that tracks light pollution, and they're called the International Dark Sky Association, or IDA. They are in Tucson, Arizona, and they're saying that now, even if you're an amateur stargazer, this is the time to go out and like view the sky, because light pollution will obviously eventually return to normal levels, and they say that it's been growing at about 2% every year. Sometimes it's registering double-digit increases for every year. And we have LED lighting, which is energy efficient, but it increases the amount of light being produced in cities. So it's like getting ever more glowing, which is bad when you want to see dark things in the sky. So in Asia, this society, the IDA, is actually trying to create something called International Dark Sky Parks, and they are in Japan and China, and they haven't been approved yet, but they are already starting that process. So, under normal conditions, where is the best place to see a dark night sky? They recommend that you go to Namibia, which is in Africa. They have deserts there that are very remote, or the deserts of Chile in South America, and they're saying that you can see the galaxies, the Milky Way galaxy, so brightly you can actually read a book by it from March to September, which is super crazy bright. They recommend, as an amateur, that you still go outside during the night sky, and especially during quarantine, look up, see what you see. They recommend getting a small telescope or binoculars so you can see kind of what's happening out there. You can look at the moon, if nothing else. There's also Venus, Mars, Saturn, and Jupiter in the morning sky, depending on the day, and you can look up when those are. But it really is a fantastic time to look up when it's dark outside, because there's never going to be a better time than now when everything's practically shut down. So, again, a silver lining to being in quarantine is being able to see space objects and celestial bodies. Something else that happened a month ago was the Lyrid meteor shower. It comes annually, and because it was during a new moon stage, we actually were able to see more meteors than normal. It said that there were about 20 visible meteors per hour in places with dark, clear skies devoid of light pollution. And of course, because of the quarantine, it was actually the best conditions in literally years to see the Lyrids. And just in case you missed it, the next meteor shower that's going to be coming with a good amount of meteors that you can see is going to be the end of summer, with a maximum date on August 12th. And it usually sports around 100 meteors per hour, and they are called the Perseids. And now something to look forward to. On Friday, May 22nd at 1:39 p.m., we will have a new moon. Of course, you won't be able to see it because it's the middle of the daytime, Eastern Daylight Time. But the same day, Venus and Mercury will actually make a close approach. So when a new moon occurs, it's when the moon is between the sun and the earth, so we have like a little shadow thing happening, and then it appears invisible to us from the earth unless the moon passes in front of the sun, which happens during a solar eclipse. So if you get up early at about 5:37 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time on May 22nd, Venus and Mercury will share the same celestial longitude. And actually, people in New York City probably won't be able to see it because they're going to be below the horizon. But by the evening time, they're going to be pretty close together. Around 8:30 p.m. local in New York City, they'll be able to see it side by side, along with the constellation Taurus the Bull. And the sun sets at 8:12 local time, so that puts the sun in an optimal position for us to see the two planets making their approach. Now, Venus is going to be the brightest object in the sky. It's shining at a magnitude of -4.1, which is just a measure of brightness used by astronomers. But Mercury is going to be a little bit harder to see. Its magnitude is only a negative 0.5, which is slightly brighter than the star Vega. So the way to see this is go and look for Venus because it's the brightest, and then you can orient yourself to find Mercury, which is going to be directly to its left. And they're going to be pretty close to the horizon, only about 13 degrees above it. So that's like a clenched fist above, roughly speaking. So go and look for that on May 22nd. And to round out today's episode, I have the next three International Space Station flyover times for you. So the first one is May 29th, that's next Friday, at 10:39 p.m. Eastern Time, and the maximum zenith angle will be 47 degrees above the horizon. It's going to be a 2-minute flyby. It starts at 26 degrees above the horizon, north northwest, moving to 47 degrees above the horizon in the northeast. The second one is Sunday, May 31st at 10:39 p.m. Again, a 2-minute flyby. It has a maximum zenith of 52 degrees above the horizon with a 2-minute flyby. It's going to start a little bit lower than the other ones. It's only 18 degrees west northwest above the horizon, and then it moves upward towards 52 degrees west southwest. And then the final one is Monday, June 1st at 9:53 p.m. It's a 3-minute flyover, so you get a little bit longer. It has 81 degrees as its maximum zenith angle, so this is the most visible of all of them, I would say. And it starts at 34 degrees above the horizon northwest, and then it moves to 32 degrees above the horizon east southeast. So you're like, okay, how do I use this information? Well, you go outside right before the time. So if the time is 10 p.m., let's say, then I would go out about 10 minutes before just to orient yourself. If the flyover starts in the northwest area, then find north. Move, like, situate yourself so that you can see both west and north, and then kind of look up about maybe halfway to the top, right? Top being like directly above you, that's going to be 90 degrees, and so that's how you're going to measure these angles. So if I'm looking for 81 degree maximum angle and it starts at 34 degrees, then I know it's roughly like a hand breadth up from the horizon, so I'm going to look probably right above the tree line, and I'm going to watch for a very, very bright dot, and it's going to be moving really, really fast towards that second number that I gave you. So if it starts at 34 degrees northwest, then I'd see it at 34 degrees northwest. It's going to go up towards the top, so it's going to probably go up over you for the June 1st one, being the maximum zenith angle of 81 degrees, which is again very close to right directly overhead, and then it's going to go towards the east southeast, which on the other side of you, and then down towards the horizon again at 32 degrees. So it'll make this big arch like over top of you, and you'll see it as a very bright spot again that's moving really, really fast. So go outside, look for these on the 29th, the 31st, and the 1st of June. Hope you enjoy talking about space weather, and join me next time.